Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Drs. Red Lawhorn and Drs. Steve Nadeau. They're here to discuss their recent paper highlighting some of the criticisms from the DEA that will be listed on the Federal Register. Now normally, I would introduce the paper and provide a nice introduction, but for today, I think that honor should go to Dr. Lawhorn. And with that, I'd like Dr. Lawhorn to go ahead, introduce his paper, and then begin the discussion.
Well, how do you do, folks? I'll start with introducing myself and Dr. Nadeau, or he can introduce himself. I am a non-clinician subject matter expert on public policy for the regulation of prescription opioid pain relievers and of clinicians who employ them in treating chronic, long-term, severe pain. I've been at this about 26 years, maybe 27 by now. I have about 200 or so publications or plus in various places, some of them with Dr. Nadeau, in peer review and general, if you will, broadcast or popular media. So I've been around a long time. I've had a lot of peer review. And we're going to talk today a little bit about a very key paper that has tremendous implications in several places, which we have written up for Dr. Joshi. I'm Richard Red, so-called Red Lawhorn, believe it or not, my hair used to be, long before I got to be active as an advocate. I am a technically trained but non-clinician subject matter expert in public policy for the prescription of opioid pain relievers and the regulation of both pain relievers and clinicians who employ them. I have about 200 plus published papers, authored or co-authored, some of them co-authored with Dr. Nadeau, in a variety of both peer-reviewed and popular mass media. So I've been around a long time. I've been looked at a long time by various and sundry editors and peer reviewers. And today we're going to talk about something that's a little bit complicated, but that I think we can probably contribute significantly, Dr. Nadeau and I. And with that, let me turn this over to Dr. Nadeau and have him introduce himself.
I'm a professor of neurology at the University of Florida College of Medicine. I've been in practice for over 40 years. Patients with chronic pain, clinical aspects of managing pain. And since 2016, I have a clinical partnership helping deeply into CDC guidelines 2016. I'll publish several peer-reviewed papers that analyze the literature on prescription of opioids on the nature of the two opioid crises, one that has been evolving since the late 70s, and one that has been brewing since about 2012, but was really formed by the CDC with its 2015 guidelines. And this is how it involves 15 to 20 million Americans with chronic myocardial because of the CDC mechanism committing suicide, mechanism crossing over to the illicit drug market, which means now, which means later giving policy.
Jay, let's proceed with you.
Dr. Lawhorn, why don't you discuss the paper and summarize it as succinctly as possible? I know there's a lot of points in there, but if you wouldn't mind perhaps going point by point and highlighting key things in the paper that are worth noting.
Okay. Let me see if I've got the right paper open here. I'll get there eventually. You might know it. Well, all right. Let's see what the heck happened here. You may have to do a little bit of removing from the recording before we go forward with it, but I'll get there in just a minute. Yeah, okay. The paper, as we have put it together, as Dr. Nato and I have constructed it, is titled Understanding Contributors to U.S. Drug-Related Mortality. And the paper is written very much out of a sense of immediate, I will say crisis, because it is an immediate crisis in both clinical communities and patient communities. Because there's been an awful lot written in public press about claimed relationships between prescribing opioids and the so-called prescription opioid crisis, or sometimes opioid epidemic, that is so widely used in media these days. But there's very conclusive proof based on data that's collected by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that for over 10 years there's been no relationship at all between rates of opioid prescribing and either hospitalizations for opioid toxicity or deaths where a prescription opioid was one of the contributing factors. And there's a very well done study published in a peer-reviewed journal. The journal is Frontiers in Pain Research. The authors of that one are respectively Larry Aubrey and B. Thomas Carr. That was in June of last year. There's also an older paper that is really what we might call seminal, because it speaks to the entire sweep of drug-related, and by that I mean all drug-related drug-related, including opioids, mortality for the last 30 years, actually since 1980, the last 45 years very nearly. And that paper is one that we concentrated on in the article that will be published on Daily Remedy. If we might, at this point, I'd like to bring up a key chart from that paper, so that we can get a look at what the data really are with regard to the contributing factors in drug-related mortality. Jay, can you bring that up for us? Okay, really good. The paper and this chart is by a group of authors headed by Howry Jalal, and I hope I'm doing his name justice. It was published in the prestigious journal Science in 2018, and the title of the paper was I need to get out of here too, sorry. I'll get the reference for that. The title of the paper was Changing Dynamics of the Drug Overdose Epidemic in the United States from 1979 through 2016. And basically, they downloaded all of the data from CDC and from the National Cause of Death database year by year throughout that period, where the primary cause of death was registered as one of eight drug or drug-related factors. And that's the chart on the left that we're seeing now. I'd like to briefly give you a few thoughts about that chart. For instance, let's take a very representative year, which is 2010. It's representative in the sense that there's some very key events that happened in that year. The least contributing factor, the lowest number of deaths that could be attributed as primarily attributable to one drug category is, in that year, 2010, it would have been methamphetamine. You go up on the chart, that's to say the left side of the chart, if you go upward, you see that Methamphetamine contributed about 0.5 deaths per 100,000 U.S. population. Way up on top in that year was prescription opioids that contributed about 2.7 or so per 100,000. And in between, you see heroin, methadone, synthetic opioids other than methadone, cocaine, unspecified narcotics, and unspecified drugs. That unspecified is important because it establishes a range of uncertainty in whether or not the attribution of death is accurate. There is no current standard that applies throughout the United States for either medical examiners or coroners to assign the primary cause of death in drug-related deaths. And in many cases, because there are multiple factors playing in a given mortality, we see that there's some possibility for attributing to more than one cause. So under the rules that generally apply, medical examiners assign their best understanding of what was the primary factor in the death, even though there may have been other factors. So what they add directly to one another, and that shows up on the right side of the chart here. And in the right side of the chart, what we see is an exponential curve that is almost smooth from 1980 to 2016, and it continues to accelerate beyond 2016 in the data that CDC has reported since. There are multiple causes contributing, but there are some very key understandings here that Jalal et al., if you will, Jalal and his colleagues have pointed out. One of them is that in any given year, the uncertainties in the estimate are about 20 to 25% of all deaths. So those are a little bit uncertain. That's kind of a range of possibilities where things probably don't quite align in these various curves on the left side, or they don't quite attribute cleanly in the curves on the left side. The other thing that comes up from this is that prescription drugs throughout this period have never comprised more than about 25% or so of attributable causes for a drug-related death of any kind. And even during the period of the pill mills that we so often hear discussed in literature, during that period prior to 2010, the contribution that prescription opioids made that we knew about that can be traced as primary causes of death has never really exceeded 25 to 30%. And after 2016, we know from other sources that the fraction of deaths contributed by opioids has dropped. And the reason it's dropped is there's so many more deaths from other causes. We also know from the chart here that in 2010, several very unhappy things happened. And one of them was that oxycodone was reformulated to reduce its abuse potential. And when it was reformulated, an awful lot of prescriptions of oxycodone were dropped out of the system. And heroin took off on a rocket. Heroin-related deaths may very well have accelerated precisely because of the unavailability of formerly diverted prescription pharmaceuticals, which were basically safe. Street markets became much more lethal. When you get all the way out to 2016, you discover that the synthetic opioids other than methadone, which are primarily comprised of fentanyl, go almost off the chart. They are on an almost vertical slope. And what's happening there is that fentanyl has penetrated U.S. street markets and is being sold in counterfeit pills that are being basically distributed to addicts and to non-medical users. Now, there's another aspect of this chart that's very important, and it's very important in our paper. Not only does the chart tell us that prescription opioids basically have never dominated opioid-related mortality, but where this chart appeared is very important. It was first discovered and referred to me by Larry Albrey, who's also been doing work in statistics here. And he found it in a conference that was published in 2019 by the Drug Diversion Division of the USDEA. That is really seminal. It's fundamental to this issue. Because what this chart and the conference proceedings tell us is that the DEA has known for at least the last four years that prescribing by clinicians to their patients has not been the dominating factor in our drug crisis. Not only do they know that that was true, they have continued to prosecute and, in my view, maliciously persecute doctors out of practice, and any doctor these days who is continuing to prescribe opioids, even though they are, in many cases for many people, the most effective of all of the available therapies, anyone who is doing that prescribing these days is at risk. But this chart is a smoking gun that the DEA knows that they shouldn't be at risk, and they are persecuting these people anyway. If there was ever a chart that was an absolute smoking gun and a basis for challenging drug convictions, that's to say, challenging convictions of clinicians by the DEA, this chart is it. Because this chart in the last 4 years tells us the DEA knows better than to blame clinicians for the opioid crisis, but they're doing it anyway. So with that in mind, let's open up the discussion and have Jay take over again. And Steve, would you like to add to this, please?
I'd just like to emphasize a couple of points, Red. I'm going to focus exclusively on the blue line, the prescription opioids line. You can see that it's a steep rise in this curve until about 2011. We now know very clearly that there were substantial opioid illness, which operated all over the country, particularly in the state of Florida, in collaboration with all of the major drug distribution companies who were making billions of dollars from this pill mill trade. The DEA tried to take action against distributors in the 2008 failed miserably, but then in 2010 and 2012, the states took measures that were very successful in completely shutting down the pill mills. And we see that starting in 2011, all of a sudden the steep rise flattens out. Now, the rise between 1999 and 2011 is the basis for the CDC claiming that prescription opioids contributed to the basis for the crisis. The CDC has never even acknowledged the presence of pill mills, but the fact that as soon as you shut down the pill mills, the curve flattens out tells you that they were really driving this huge expansion or huge increase in opioid-associated deaths. And that's the most fundamental error by the CDC. Everything else it claims rests on that error. And they have been unwilling to hear otherwise. This is verified in the 2022 revision. They held the same old claim that prescription opioids were driving crisis to the last year, 2016, there's a decline in prescription opioid deaths. There's some are statistical, epidemiological, who these are. We know for certain that there are a couple of contributors. So one is the chronic pain will be rendered desperate by limitations treatment by the CDC and the VA crossed over to the illicit drug market, which means one day or another that fentanyl and times more potent, heroin, other times more potent than morphine. We've also known for a long time since this study, time ago, there are patients who mainly survive with illicit drugs, feed their addictions with illicit drugs, but sometimes will cross over to the clinical population if they all safe source of opioids. But when they die from illicit opioids, that death, because they have a prescription for prescription opioids in the past year, that death will be dropped up to prescription opioids. So I think those are probably the two major contributors to the patients when in 2013 on, both the complete failure of CDC to provide strategy and abject failure of this country to deal with the population of
If I might add emphasis to the point that Steve just made, basically a position that I've taken in other papers and that we have given considerable support to, even if it wasn't stated exactly that way in the journal articles we published, there is evidence that the nature of these contributors was known to the people who wrote the updated CDC guidelines on prescription of opioids and published them in November of last year. It was known to them, but they ignored it. And there are a number of other problems which we don't need to get into in this particular podcast, but what Dr. Nato and I are saying basically, and the point, if you will, the foot-stopping point that really is the bottom line in the short paper that you'll be publishing on Daily Remedy, is that the CDC has fundamentally misdirected the practice of pain medicine in this country by using coercive means that are not founded on appropriate science and that are significantly contradicted by established science in many areas. Those guidelines have to go wherever stupid things die. If you'll pardon the way I put this, I'm being a little vernacular. But bottom line is both the VA, the CDC guidelines and the VA guidelines are based on junk science and assertions that don't prove, that don't stand up if you give them the least examination from the standpoint of what the data looks like. The chart that you have up now, Jay, is what the data looks like. We have a real drug crisis in America, but it wasn't produced by doctors, and it isn't being sustained by doctors. The number one crisis in America is street drugs, where the thing that makes them lethal isn't supply, it is demand. And there's an abundant literature in that demonstrates that the demand is created not by doctors, but by the conditions in which people live, the desperation and anxiety that is generated by what we call the social determinants of health. Things like 50 years of real wage stagnation and the hollowing out of both inner city and rural communities, the loss of family, and the increasing, and perhaps the increasing political dissension that we experience in this country. We have misdirected resources for a great long time. And we're going to, if we want to solve the drug problem, quote, quote, we have to define it properly. And that means we have to stop blaming doctors for something they didn't do.
Well said. Let me take this now to a higher level to maybe draw some key points and extrapolate out some general concepts for the listening audience. First off, I want to thank you both for your in-depth analysis on the graphs. I think it's very important that people start to study these in the detail that it requires. I want to take a higher level approach and focus on three concepts. One is the uncertainty and the percentage of uncertainty that was cited. The second is the correlation and causation argument. And the third is the attribution error. When I reviewed your paper and I'm reviewing your analysis just now, I see that there's different sources of error that each have its own implication. And I want to understand, maybe less so quantitatively and maybe at a broader, higher level, what is the significance of data having this much uncertainty in it? And how does that lead to sources of error like correlation versus causation and attribution error? And Red, if you'd like to begin first.
Yeah, I'll do that. If we properly labeled the uncertainty in the estimate, and we looked at the right side of this chart, what we would see is not lines with points. We would see sort of fuzzy worms that move in a general direction with error bounds, upper and lower. For instance, let's say we look at prescription drugs in 2011, and it says there's a mortality rate of about 3 deaths per 100,000. If we were able to appropriately define the error bounds, what we would see is a band in that year that probably runs from somewhere around 4 deaths per 100,000 to somewhere as long as 2.5 deaths per 100,000. It would be a broad band because a lot of the assigned causes as the primary cause of prescription drugs, if the assigned causes have uncertainty in them, all of these lines would be somewhat fuzzy worms making their way across the chart. Now, likewise, we have to realize, and Dr. Nato spoke to this just a moment ago, many times what happens is that a county examiner, and in a lot of counties, the county examiner may not even have a medical degree. A lot of the county examiners have very limited resources, and when they assign a primary cause of death, it's after they have looked to see, was there an existing prescription? What other factors were going on? Was there a suicide note left? Were drugs found on the body, if you will, or nearby? Any kind of drugs found. And likewise, one contributor to uncertainty that we don't even see on this chart is alcohol, because many deaths involve a combination of alcohol and either prescription drugs or street drugs, where people are basically drinking and drugging themselves to numb the pain, sometimes to numb the physical pain. Now, this leads us into the question of why is correlation so very dangerous if you misuse it? Well, there's an old phrase, a mathematician recognizes it, and I've taught it to analysts for much of my 60-year career. Correlation is not cause. Simply because event A happens a little bit before event B doesn't mean that A caused B. But there is something else that a lot of politicians never hear. Without correlation, without some association that you see between event A and event B, there is no cause and effect. So if you have data that don't show an association between, let us say, prescribing and bad outcomes, notably either hospitalizations or opioid-related mortality, if you don't have data that conclusively show that relationship, then you don't have a relationship, period. But that gets omitted from many of the memes and assertions that anti-opioid zealots, and I do use that term advisedly because it applies, opioid zealots don't want to hear it, don't want to take the chance that the zealots are going to catch them in any kind of an error. So they don't want to prescribe, because even though they know there is no correlation, even though they have seen it confirmed in their own practices, There's somebody on a medical board that is basically not a doctor, because a lot of medical boards have representatives of the public on them too. Someone who is a politician or the political appointee of a politician will say, yeah, well, this doctor prescribed a huge volume of opioids. That means he has to be guilty. And the result of that is that doctors get railroaded. Now, you mentioned another generality. Repeat it for us so we can respond to it, Jay.
I'm sure it was attribution, and you alluded to a bit when you talked about assigning, where when Dr. Nadeau gave the analogy of a patient who may alternate between illicit substances and prescription substances, and you mentioned it about the attribution factors, where, quote, right, is there alcohol involved? Is there a prescription, whether that's relevant or not? Is there a suicide note? And I think that's very important to mention, because this linear checkbox system of attributing often leads to cognitive error, because you're making baseline assumptions on the attribution of death based on the presence or absence of particular factors without taking a more in-depth understanding of that. And I think that's something you both can allude to a bit further.
Absolutely. Let me add something to that, because it's interesting from other research that Steve and I have done. There was a study done of the Veterans Administration. The primary author was Oliva, I believe. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing her name correctly. They took a look at a year of data and on suicides and dependency. I'm not sure which one it was. Back in 2010 to 2011, and they built a predictive model that says if we see certain factors, how risky is it? Or how much risk, how much likelihood is there that if we see certain factors, and they name something like 15 of them, that somebody that we have treated with an opioid or even without an opioid in 2010 will have a serious occurrence of either an overdose-related mortality, opioid misuse in the year following. Now, here's the thing that's a real bottom line on this. When they looked at this data, and they looked at the highest risk population, 1,000 out of something over a million patients that were tracked in the VA system, it turns out that factors that have nothing to do with medical treatment were 2 to 4 times more important than factors relating to past medical treatment in predicting the outcomes when they were bad outcomes in 2011. Now, that's confirming to us that the prescription of opioids and the duration of prescription and the doses prescribed are much less important than a past history of mental health issues, clinical depression, substance use disorder, and vets have a lot of them, because vets are often very traumatized individuals who've been through a lot of bad news. People coming out of the sandbox, which is to say coming out of the Middle East, very frequently have drug use issues. Not because they're bad people, because they've been stressed to the breaking point or wounded or both. So what we're finding out is that there's no real correlation between exposure to a medical opioid and a bad outcome downstream. A previous history of problems with behavioral health, problems with addiction from any source, not medical necessarily, problems with depression, is much more indicative of someone who needs to be monitored more closely than anything having to do with their past history. In the medical sense. And that's another point that Steve and I have made. One of the things that clinicians often, I won't say often, sometimes do not do well is they do not profile their patients for depression and anxiety. And they are told that they really shouldn't treat depression with benzodiazepine drugs. And the benzos are moderators for both depression and anxiety. But when you don't do that, when you don't treat with the best you have, you expose the patient to a significant risk of downstream bad news outcomes, because you can't treat effectively unless you're treating the whole person. And that means you need to understand where their mood is, where their affect is, generally whether they're able to process and appropriately moderate their own care, if you will. So there are lots of interacting factors here. We don't want to misrepresent that in any way. And the interacting factors are such that we know with absolute certainty that doctors prescribing to their patients didn't make the U.S. opioid crisis. We also know that the DEA knows that. And that should become a basis for challenging and overturning convictions of clinicians who have been accused and who have often been coerced into settling charges having to do with practicing outside the bounds of usual and normal medicine or overprescribing. Overprescribing did not create the U.S. opioid crisis, not even close. Steve, you want to add?
I'm going to very briefly amplify on 3 points. So one is to speak specifically to the question that Jay raised. That's really reflected, answered by the study of Oliva, which by the way was a large population. Clearly, the results didn't make many people happy, and they have to publish in a third journal. But what you really found, colleagues, is that people who were dying of overdose, suicide attempts, were people who had desperate mental health conditions, prescribed opioids, because in addition to their psychiatric disorder, had So it turns out in the study that opioid dosage made a very small contribution to the probability of overdose or death. The opioids were almost incidental, or perhaps simply the tool that patients used when in desperation to. Turns out, well, that's exactly why people using illicit drugs are becoming addicts. And coping is the same sort of suffering because of the psychic and socioeconomic things that we're alluding to. Second, I want to say that the situation with ascertaining of death is improving, sometimes at the local level, but I'll give you an example from the CDC itself. So, in 2018, New England Journal, the CDC was counting fentanyl deaths with prescription opioid deaths, and obviously, fentanyl deaths were going into the stratosphere. So it made prescription opioids look horrible. But, the spiraling death rates have zero to do with prescription opioids. And the last thing is something that hangs over all of this. And that is really back in the days after the Civil War, when so many soldiers were suffering injury, terrible, what we know now was PTSD, and were treating themselves with heroin. It was known as the soldier's disease. Well, that started, listening to all kinds of things, that started movement towards CD-prohibition, which ultimately became an amendment to the Constitution for alcohol. Not for opioids. Instead, it led to the start of the drug war in the 1960s. 2020, which continues today and seems to solve the whole crisis strictly by going to the supply side rather than the demand side, has been an absolutely dismal perception of opioids as continues on the white public. It's very strong. You see it on patients, you see patients terribly stigmatized because of this. Physicians have inadequate, even to this day, received remotely adequate training in the treatment of pain and use of opioids. And like any human being who's poorly trained in using them, they're fearful. They tend to see it for proclivity to see everything that they prescribe opioids for. The CDC has taken full advantage of cultivating these false beings in the cult. And now those beings permeate everything. They permeate the scientific literature, editors of scientific journals. They dominate the scene in order to support these false memes. At an incredible level. When I first got into this with Red in 2015, I had all this experience in treatment. It was completely odd with what the CDC was reporting in its guideline. I thought, what the heck? What do I know? Let's examine each and every one of these CDC premises and see what science really says. And eventually the conclusion arrived at is there's essentially no decent science in the CDC guidelines, either 16 or 22. I concluded that, well, they missed the mark, but they would pursue the 16 guideline. But the 22 guideline came out for public commentary last year, and there was huge input from patients, suffering desperately, and from scientists. If you look at the introduction to the 2022 guidelines, it specifically lists the people whose input was considered in reformulating the guideline, and studiously excluded scientists. So that's all. This is not a mistake. This is not insufficient evaluation of scientific evidence. This is deliberate. It must be politically motivated. Now we understand why that is, too. And that may be our appeal for this podcast. So I'll leave it there.
We can come back and use our smoking gun, if you will, for other broadcasts if Jay wants to invite us.
Well, let's do this. Let's touch on the notion of liability and particularly DEA culpability after we've discussed a little bit more on the statistics itself. I think it's very important for the listening audience to get a deep grasp of the numbers and how they're manipulated. For many who may be watching this for the first time, this graph may seem exceedingly complex. They may be used to looking at a simple graph that correlates prescription opioids and opioid overdose deaths. And in those numbers, as you guys know, they aggregate a lot of those mortality numbers in ways that give off a certain impression that may or may not be true. And that has created this persistence in a misperception on attributing, as we discussed earlier, falsely prescription opioids with overdose rates. So I want you guys to talk a little bit about how data gets manipulated. Are there statistical methods by which they manipulate the data, or are they manipulating the inputs themselves as they formulate a preconceived outcome? Talk a little bit about how these numbers are manipulated to give a preconceived outcome.
Okay, here's a thought. If you take all of the data from individual states, and you lump it all together and you say, okay, as a function of the amount that is prescribed to the state population, that's to say prescriptions per 100,000, is there a relationship between the amount that's prescribed and the number of deaths in that state that are attributed to narcotics? And that exercise has been done. It's been done multiple times by multiple people. I'm one of them. You look state by state, and what you realize is that if you plot that data, 50 points, that's the 50 U.S. states, the overdose rate, excuse me, the overdose mortality rate versus the sales of opioids in that state, you'll get a pattern that looks like a shotgun blast on the barn door. It doesn't have a trend line in it, or if the trend line is there, it's flat. What it means is that if opioids as prescribed were really going to be accredited as a major driver of the opioid crisis, we should see higher overdose rates in states that have higher prescription rates, but we don't. And that factor is religiously excluded from all discussions of this issue by the CDC. It's cherry picking. Again, I've mentioned Larry Aubrey and B. Thomas Carr. They did an excellent job going state by state to find out what was the relationship state by state and year by year between opioid sales versus hospitalizations. And here's what they found out. From 2010 to 2019, prescribing dropped off from roughly a morphine milligram equivalent per 100,000 of almost 800 in thousands. That's to say, other than, I'll get this right, the green curve, let's focus there. MME per capita is the amount that was prescribed and sold. From 2010 to 2019, it dropped by 55%. But the total overdose deaths rise from roughly 38,000 to well over 70,000, and they keep on going.
That's the TOD line.
That's the TOD line, right. And admissions rise and then flatten off. There is some flattening in the period of 2018 to 2019, but it's temporary. They go up after that. We have the data to show that. Aubrey and Carr did one more thing that was fascinating. They plotted this data differently to show what is the curve state by state between the MME sold versus deaths in that state from opioid-related causes. And what they found out was states that have higher levels of prescribing have lower levels of deaths. The curve is literally reversed. MME per capita has a downward to the right shape. But if you had a different axis there and you were plotting the level of prescribing on the horizontal axis versus the opioid-related admissions and deaths, the more you prescribe, the less death there is. That result, I might add, also parallels and reinforces the findings of Howriet, of Jalal and his colleagues. They found the same thing because they did the same kind of analysis with data from a different source. So what this chart tells us is not only is there no relationship, there's no model. There's no mathematics that can explain that green curve versus the top level red curve. You cannot assume that opioids are the source of our opioid crisis and get these results. You can't do it. It doesn't happen. It's that clear. But this is something that the CDC and many other writers that are profoundly anti-opioid in their orientation absolutely refuse to embrace and deal with. They would rather ignore it. And this is an evidence that I think, frankly, is fraud. I think it's fraud on the part of the CDC, and it's fraud basically because of the political aspect of this, and Steve spoke to that very briefly. I hope that's responsive to your concern, Jay.
Dr. Nadeau?
Can we go back to the Jalal et al. Graphs?
Got it.
So first, I'm going to say something that has nothing to do with the graphs. It's an illustration of the way that CDC has drawn completely false conclusions from the analysis of the data. So there have been over 100 controlled trials of opioids for treatment, which they look at all of them all together, which provided some evidence that opioids are effective for treating chronic pain. But it's not really conclusive. Innumerable men was seized of all of those trials. And they just think every randomized control trial available and throw it in the statistical pot and massage the numbers and come up with their conclusions without consideration of the quality of the data. What distinguishes all of these trials is very short. Very long trials, 6 months, many of them are 3 months. And the reason they're short is that each trial is a race to titrate opioid dosage before the placebo patients run out and you lose any statistical power.
Very interesting.
CDC has concluded from this failure to demonstrate efficacy that it's actually a proof of inefficacy, which is, absolutely an incorrect conclusion. And it turns out that the problem with all of those trials is that the study design is simply not adequate to the task. And we published for a revised design that actually would be capable of truly testing whether opioids are effective for chronic pain, and it would enable you to run these trials as long as you wanted, 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever that you wanted, because the trial design could enable that. But here's CDC looking at all of these design trials, drawing a completely unjustified inference. She finds it suits the myth that they're trying to sell. I want to address your second question, Jay, and that is to left chart over here, the two Jalal graphs. So, this is spaghetti plot and easily get lost. But there's really just three takeaways. So one is the blue line, which is prescription opioids, and we've talked about that extensively. The second is the yellow line, which is below the blue line, corresponding to unspecified drugs, which is a measure of persisting uncertainty in being able to determine which drug or drugs, and it is usually multiple drugs and alcohol. And third is you can take all of those curves, heroin, fentanyl, methamphetamine, imogen, treat them all the same, because what happened is once the pill mills were shut down, there was no way for these vast addicted populations to get opioids. And there we had Mexican heroin entrepreneurs and Chinese fentanyl. And they were all subject to the market and satisfied those addictions, but with much deadlier problems, particularly fentanyl, and this is that the most large for the three trends that we need to see here. Prescription opioids at the Pell Mills were shut down. Persistence of still unspecified drugs. And then
can I add a footnote, please, to Steve? There are analysts in this business who look at these curves and other related data, and what they tell us is that the DEA is responsible for creating the drug crisis, because the DEA falsely believed that supply was the issue and went after it, and in the process, they drove people into the streets. It's what we call a perfect storm of policy misdirection. One of those writing in this field is a fellow by the name of Jeffrey Singer. He's with the Cato Institute. He's done some brilliant work in studying the relationship between law enforcement and bad outcomes in the opioid crisis. And his work is worth reviewing. Sometime maybe we will. Bottom line, what all of this data adds up to, just as Steve has spoken to, is that DEA is the problem, not the solution. And the CDC has made the problem worse by fraudulently misrepresenting cause and effect and knowing that they did it when they did it. The CDC needs to be removed from all future policymaking roles in the development of clinical practice standards for the management of pain. They have clearly demonstrated that they are politically biased and basically incompetent to do the right thing. I'm going to have to depart the fix pretty quick, guys. Are we at a point where we can wrap this up?
Yeah, let me ask final questions for both of you, just about a minute each, and then we can wrap this up. You guys provided significant information that I hope the listening audience can learn from and implement their own experiences with to understand why they're being treated the way they are if they're patients, and why they're making decisions as they are if they're in the healthcare field. What is the general context of this paper and to analyze all of these numbers? Can you talk a little bit about the Federal Register and what you guys hope to gain out of presenting this data to the public?
You want that one, Steve?
For a long time, these formidable obstacles, and I think only within the last year, even though I was well aware that there was some chicanery going on in the development of the CDC. Was really a politically driven effort to do with the federal opioid crisis, and that the solutions to both treatment of food crisis, the illicit opioid crisis, and the horrible harm that CDC has and continues to cause is really political. It's been a long nearly all of these things. There's still things to be discovered, and I, you know, we've got a paper that gives the whole history of this, the causes that's on the cusp of being accepted. Just let me do other thoughts about how actually the different opioids, the different experiences. Clinical science assumes that it's the same experience and something along the line of euphoria. CDC guidelines has concluded that opioids are ineffective, in essence, telling everybody who listens, don't fret it, we're not losing anything. Opioids are ineffective, so what do we care? Why should anybody care about losing them, which should be further from them?
May I speak specifically to the Federal Register question that Jay posed? There is now a request for comments in the Federal Register concerning the proposed opioid production quotas for next year. Actually, proposed quotas for all of the scheduled drugs that DEA has oversight on and legislative authority to control. Steve and I originally started with a comment to that request for comments for the DEA when we wrote the paper that has generated the discussion we've just had. Basically, what we are saying to the DEA is that the entire premise of your production quota proposal is flat wrong. We need to greatly expand the availability of opioids because we are destroying the lives of patients and clinicians by an artificial and scientifically unjustified contraction of supply. The whole premise that by contracting supply you will help people is flat out wrong. There's no science for it. There's no ethics behind it. It's got to be stopped. Now, I'm being very emphatic, but I will tell you that there are literally hundreds of thousands of people out there who have been damaged by these policies. They want to see the DEA abolished. And I have to say I have some sympathy for them because DEA has been misrepresenting this crisis for years. And they have consistently, year by year, failed in their mission. So we need to consider whether or not the actual removal of the DEA might be part of the legislative agenda.
So on that note, Dr. Lawhorn, Dr. Nadeau, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it and look forward to carrying the conversation forward.